So this is day two, lesson two. We've been talking about divorce and remarriage. If you got, I see Chris is back there with the handouts. I think we ended up somewhere between page 3 and 4, and we had looked at a couple of different texts. We looked at the Old Testament, and we were looking at the Pharisees coming to Matthew to question Jesus. So I thought if you would like to look back, we would read through the Matthew passage. It's on page 2, Matthew 19, 3 through 9. Then we'll kind of jump in there and catch up to where we've been. Good morning. Good morning. So Matthew 19, 3 through 9. Some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And he answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command, give her a certificate of divorce, and send her away?' He said to them, 'Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman commits adultery.'" Okay. So that was kind of one of the key texts that we looked at. And so as we get into divorce and remarriage, just kind of let's back up. When we think about marriage in general, from the beginning, mm-hmm. When should a marriage end? We talked about this a little bit. There's one time.
Death.
Yes, all right. So marriage should end, right? When does it end? It should end at death. And so we're looking at Matthew, where Jesus is explaining, he's being questioned about, is it lawful to just divorce for any reason at all? And so some of the context that I was looking at in terms of that time, the Roman government, seemed very similar to where we're at now, where people can, husbands and wives, divorce for any reason at all. It might have been a little bit more difficult in the Jewish culture, but in the Roman world at that time, there's just no reason need to be given. If a husband or the wife went to divorce, they could divorce them and end the marriage. And so they're trying to kind of catch and trap Jesus. And so Jesus addresses this, right? And what does he say initially? Does he give any cause for, when he quotes Genesis, he gives the Genesis passage, and then what does he say after that in verse 6? Yeah, seems to be very clear, right? So he kind of answers initially, no, it's not lawful to divorce your wife for any reason at all. Basically, no one should end their marriage. There should be no divorce. And then what do? They follow up with this passage. And we looked at this a little bit in Deuteronomy, right? So he said, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" And that passage is down below, the bottom of verse page 2 and 3. And we talked a little bit about how they've got a little misinterpretation going on. Okay, so we're going to read through the passage and see if you can catch, or maybe you remember it from last time. They're posing to Jesus that, why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? So let's look at the passage and see if you can see where they're misinterpreting. "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. And she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that's an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. So what are they getting wrong when they look at that passage? They quote it, why did this happen? And then we read it ourselves. No, you think
so? The command is not to remarry the divorced wife.
Right.
Instead of they're saying it's the command is to divorce.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. So they took and interpreted that the first part, the condition where he's describing a situation, they interpreted that to mean that you are commanded, right? If you find this indecency, you are commanded to write this certificate of divorce, right? But instead, we look at the text, there's no command in verses 1, verses 2, verses 3. He's describing, if this happens, then the command is, you shall not. And why was he not to take her back in marriage? I think this is around where we ended last time.
She would have committed adultery.
Yeah. And so, when you think about, that brings us to the Matthew passage. The consistent message in the Old Testament and what we see in Jesus in Matthew 19, what does he say, right? Anyone who divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman, what? What's going on there?
Commits adultery.
Yeah, he's committing adultery. So most of the time you have divorce is leading to adultery. And so the question is, right, what we're trying to talk about is there a time where divorce, right, does not lead to adultery? Or is there a time when a marriage can end other than death? Right? That's kind of the question that we're dealing with. So think back to, and the word that Jesus used there, immorality, it can be translated a few ways. It's porneia. It can mean sexual immorality. Sometimes it's adultery. It's going to refer back. So they had in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, these sexual laws against incest, homosexuality, bestiality, adultery. That's kind of this sexually immoral context. And so, other than, right, death, right, what did Jesus say? When can a divorce not end in adultery?
Porneia.
Yeah, porneia. So, kind of we have this, right, what about, right, we'll call it sexual immorality. Now, in the Old Testament, why were those, what was the difference between those? Originally, look at, it's on page 3 there. What's Leviticus 20:10? So you see that one? Yeah. So it's virtually the same thing. If the husband or the wife were to commit adultery, sexual immorality, they would be put to death. And that ends the marriage. And then at that point, they're released from the law. If you have your Bible, look over in Romans chapter 7. This is kind of a New Testament reminder of the same privilege. In Romans 6, Paul's teaching through being dead to sin and alive to God, and how you are either a slave to sin, and when you die to being a slave to sin, you can be alive and slave to righteousness. And he gives this illustration at the beginning of Romans 7. Okay, so Tanner, are you going to read 7, 1 and 2? Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Or do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives. For a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage.
Yeah, and he even goes on and continues that this kind of same reasoning by saying, accordingly, she'll be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive, but if her husband dies, she is free from that law. So he's kind of giving that as an illustration, something that they're very familiar with, that death ends that marriage relationship. Okay, so the question then becomes a couple things. right? What does this constitute? Right? So, we want to make sure we know what that is. And then also, I think the question is the difference between it being permissible and it being commanded, right? So how would you counsel someone as to if they were asking you, what's the Bible say if my husband or my wife has been unfaithful, they've committed adultery? What does it say? What's the difference between a divorce being permissible versus commanded?
Permissible gives you an option.
Mm-hmm. Versus
no option,
right? Mm-hmm. So if the Bible taught command, it would say anytime there's adultery, you should end it in divorce, right? So what other option do you have if it's just an option? Yeah. Yeah. So we have death ends, and then porneia is maybe, right? It's possible that sexual morality could end a marriage, right? But when we get here, it could be, right, that if this happens, there can be reconciliation. Or it could end in divorce. And so that's kind of a change from, right, in the Old Testament where sexual morality, it ought to end in death, and that it should be capital punishment. Now that there's this mercy, there's this possibility that the sexual morality could be forgiven. They're not necessarily put to death. The other spouse, right, they have to make that choice. Are they able to do reconciliation, or is divorce the best option? What are some factors that you think should go into that process, thinking through that?
Do they have children?
Okay, children.
Mm-hmm.
Are they what?
Repentant.
Yeah, are they repentant?
What else? Timeline, how long ago did sexual morality happen?
Mm-hmm. How long did it
endure?
Is it still going on?
Mm-hmm.
Do they want?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can be a very, very messy, and I'm assuming you think about the billions of people on the earth and all the marriages, I'm assuming that even though some of the examples that we might think of may seem very hypothetical, you're probably going to run into almost every variation of items there. And a lot of times there's not just the issue of the adultery, there's the deception, and the cover-up, is there something else? Is there a hidden life? Are there other children from the unfaithful? So it's a difficult decision. Okay.
Yeah, I'd say one more thing too is it's not like if there's past immorality that you have this get out of jail free card that you can use at any point in time in the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
What we normally do is, if somebody discovers that their husband or their wife was committing adultery,
mm-hmm.
We usually say, don't be intimate until you're ready to forgive, and mm-hmm. you know what that means. Because intimacy is kind of like the covenant sign of marriage, right? You re-engage that, and that's assuming that they're repentant, you know, that no new information is going to come
mm-hmm.
out. That is done earnestly and truly.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, it's like you can't play that card anymore.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like that's always...
It's always there.
It's
yeah,
always there.
On the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned intimacy. You going to ask something, buddy? Thought?
Another question?
Yeah.
I guess my question would be, like, what role does hope play in this? Because some seem to lose hope, and obviously it depends on if they're repentant and all those things we said, the factors, right? But
mm-hmm.
like you said, you've seen every example of, like, mm-hmm. there is no hope, and the wife or the husband has stuck it out, and they've
mm-hmm.
found reconciliation months, a year
mm-hmm.
later, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, it just seems like some make the decision up front and some make the decision later.
Mm-hmm.
How do you counsel through that, seeing both sides?
Well, we're going to get to it in a minute, but one thing, go ahead and turn to 1 Corinthians. Because you mentioned, and Dave talked a little bit about, what about that stage where maybe something has happened, maybe there's been adultery, but there's not been a divorce, and we're kind of evaluating what to do. So, 1 Corinthians 7, there's a lot of principles that Paul is giving toward marriage. And down in verse 10 and on, he says, "To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife." So he's saying they ought not to get a divorce, but there's a sense in which you get, there's this hope, right? If she does separate, what does he say? Remain unmarried or else be reconciled to your husband. And then if you follow on, then starting in 12, he addresses the rest. So not just the believers in the church, the believing marriages. "I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy." So there's a sense in which there's a lot of hopefulness in the sense of what might happen with the unbelieving spouse, the unbelieving children. He does say, "But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace." And then verse 16, "For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you'll save your wife?" So there's a sense in which he's saying there's a lot of things that might happen that you don't know, right? And so there's this, there is a sense of hope that you have to, you're waiting to see kind of what is going to bear fruit there.
So in verse 12 it says, "But the rest I say, not the Lord."
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, Bible is the word of God,
mm-hmm.
everything within it, good for instruction and teaching, and it, again, is the word of God, then why does it matter for him to say, like, why would he say, "I say this, not the Lord"?
Mm-hmm. I think that what he's saying there is that he has heard, read, talked to, and has been aware of all of the public teaching of Jesus. And when he says earlier, "not I, but the Lord," like this is something that is well established as part of Jesus' teaching. And I think what he's saying here is that he is now applying that, and he's not aware of Jesus ever giving an explicit teaching on this particular situation of the married and the unbeliever, the believing and unbelieving, and saying, "I'm saying this, it wasn't in the Lord's teaching, but I'm applying his principles and what he taught about marriage." So it still has the equal weight as word of God. That's how I'd say it. Yeah?
Where does pornography fit into this?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it, just as adultery can be very widespread, you know, pornography is spread as well. So let's turn to Matthew 5. I'm going to use this kind of as an illustration when we talk about pornography. So right next to each other, in 21 through 26, we see Jesus teaching about anger. And then right after that, from 27 to 30, we see him talking about lust, right? And so, I have anybody that wants to read 21 to 26 there in 5? Go for it, yeah.
"You have heard that it was said to those who of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny.
Yeah. So there Jesus is drawing a connection between anger and what? Anger and
murder.
Murder, right? And so our question is, right, we're going to kind of apply that principle, but let's continue reading. So can I get somebody else? 27 to 30. Go ahead, Leo.
You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one of your members than it is for your whole body to go to hell.
Yeah, so he, in a similar way, he addresses lust and kind of talks about it compared with adultery. And so the big picture he's getting across is that the Pharisees were probably priding themselves on not, I've never killed anyone, right, on their righteousness over here. And he's pointing out that they're equally deserving of judgment because they're sinning and having the intent in their heart, okay? He says you've committed adultery with her in your heart. But one thing is that he in no way says that when you are guilty of anger, you ought to be punished in the same way that a murderer would be. You ought not to be put to death because you had anger in your heart. So there's a difference between your guilt and your liability before God and his judgment and the civil consequences relationally. The person doesn't actually die when you're angry with them, although you have guilt, you're guilty of that intent. And so my take would be that when you have pornography in there, they are guilty of committing adultery in their heart, but I would not say that it fits the context of sexual morality or adultery that would end in the or potentially end the marriage. In the same way that anger, you would be guilty of murdering your heart, but you would not be able to be prosecuted for murder in that sense. I would draw a distinction there. I know that there is a discussion of, prolonged, unrepentant pornographic use, and is that a grounds for a divorce? We've had that discussion before. But. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
Yeah, something that kind of helps me with that is part of the allowance for divorce is the death penalty is not enforced for sexual sins.
Yeah.
And so would they get the death penalty for this? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yes in the Old Testament law, then mm-hmm. I would say divorce would be permitted.
And that's a good way to think about it. Like if you go back to Leviticus 18, there's a host of, not your mother-in-law, father-in-law, sibling, all these ancestral, if you would have gotten the death penalty before, it would have ended your marriage and you could remarry. Mm-hmm. If God is now showing grace and allowing that person to live who has committed the sin, this person who would have been free married, he shows them or gives them that permission or that grace that they may have the option of still ending the marriage. Where it would have ended in death, now it could end in divorce if that person would have been executed for that sin or that action. So it concedes that you can still carry on the Old Testament thought when your spouse commits this sin that could end the marriage if you're unable to or unwilling to or because of all these different situations. If reconciliation, if forgiveness is not possible. And I think I was really challenged. I would encourage you if you're thinking through some of these, read through Hosea, right? Have you guys... if you want to flip to the beginning of Hosea, it's 14 chapters, not too long. in the book. So Hosea was a prophet, and in chapter 1, verse 2, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom, and have children of whoredom, for the land commits a great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. So he takes Gomer, who is a prostitute. Later in chapter 3, the Lord said to me, "Go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethich of barley. And I said to her, 'You must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you.'" So God calls Hosea to demonstrate his forgiving, pursuing love to this faithless and adulterous nation of Israel. And he marries this adulterous woman who's committing adultery against him. He's continuing. So it's an amazing picture of the mercy and the forgiveness of God. And I think it's difficult to sometimes put yourself in the position against God as being the adulterous one. I think it'd be difficult if you were faced with forgiving and reconciling with an adulterous spouse. Oftentimes, in any sort of forgiveness, it's easy to forget our own sins against God and to elevate. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 7, and we'll look at this unbelieving and believing marriage of it. Is there any kind of thoughts as we get into this, questions you have, if you've been reading through, or I know many of the ladies studied, still things that are on your mind as you think about this? We're going to read this passage, 12 through 16, where he's talking about, what if you have a believing spouse married to an unbelieving spouse? What ought we to do? Any questions you have thinking as we go into this? Does anyone familiar have family members or friends that are in a situation like this where they are in a believing and they know, or maybe they have an unbelieving spouse?
I mean, I have a question. So how would you, with all of this, how would you counsel somebody who's in like a toxic marriage but they have children?
A lot of it would depend on what's making it toxic. You know, I think that one of the facts about marriage is that you have two sinners that are married together. And so what is it that's going on? I think there's a tremendous amount that we shortcut in terms of the sanctification of the husband and the wife, mm-hmm. in dealing with sin, because your marriage oftentimes will bring out sins that you can be sanctified from that don't show up. Like, you can kind of conceal them with everybody else, but your spouse, who's with you day in and day out, begins to see those. I think the first part would always be, my goal would be to see, is there a way, I mean, can we reconcile? And as long as neither one of them is committing, you know, sexual morality, adultery, I would say, you know, divorce, you shouldn't even have that as an option. We will talk about there may be times where for periods, there might be a small bit of separation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's a part of the counsel as well. So there is this kind of in between that might be used at times.
Chris and I have been studying 1 Corinthians 7 mm-hmm. together for the last few months. The problem that we've come up against is, if a woman or man claims their spouse was not a Christian, then are they free to remarry? It seems like it's a double standard, a way to get out of it, to remarry and not divorce or not commit adultery is to claim your spouse at the time was not a Christian. And you may have said he was, or she was.
So in the situation you're talking about, so there's a marriage going on. One claims that they're a believer.
Right.
And has the other one left, or has there been a divorce, or there? What?
Yes.
Yes, one left, and
yes.
And there was a divorce.
Claimed the person that stayed behind was not a Christian, or the person that left was not a Christian. I mean, who makes that call?
Well, I think what we're going to see is that, like, when we would say that, really, if it's not death, it has to be, there has to be sexual morality. And then there could be divorce. So if those two, and I would say, when you look at marriage, you have a man leaves his father and mother, so there's the, I don't know if I would call this the official, right, the wedding ceremony. And then there's the one flesh. So to enter marriage, you don't just have the ceremony, the legal, the public, the declaration, you don't just have the one flesh. Those two together, you enter in through a wedding, a man leaves his father and mother and he's united to his wife, and the two become one flesh, and now you're bound together, cleaved together.
Yeah, I think
so. Coming out, there has to be a breaking of that one flesh bond of sexual morality, and then there has to be an official public divorce, and then there's freedom to remarry.
Yeah, Paul is saying if you're married to an unbeliever and they choose to live, let them go. You're free to remarry. So who makes the decision that person is not a believer?
Well, let's look at that text. Let's look at that. So
okay.
Let's read 12 through 16. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they're holy. Okay, so now we get to verse 15. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? So when you look at the wording there, I would say that when he says, let him leave, he's not saying divorce them. Saying let them leave. You're under no bondage to continue to keep them the marriage. But when he says, how do you know whether you will save your husband, I believe he's opening that up to allowing for separation from the unbelieving spouse. Now, if that unbeliever or whoever has left, if they leave and they've engaged in a new relationship, that then gives them grounds to file for divorce, or if the unbeliever leaves and they file for divorce, that has ended the marriage. Okay, but it's on, I believe that the directions here is that they're looking for peace. They're not, when it says God has called us to peace, you're not going to stop them, you're not going to try and continue to keep them in the marriage, but you are not going to be the one that takes the steps to officially end the marriage. That's going to be, you're waiting, there's a hope of, during that separation, if there's a possibility of reconciliation. And I think that if you look at the texts that go along with this, it's only through death or the sexual morality that could lead to divorce that would end the marriage. But those two, I would say those two have to happen in order to be free to remarry. So let's say someone leaves and they just left. We fight irreconcilable differences and neither one files for divorce. They're still married, so neither one's free to remarry. If the unbelieving one leaves and they file for divorce, the fact where it says, let them leave, you can then consent to the divorce. Sometimes the question is, when should, let's say the spouse has left, the divorce just became final, but there's not been any sign or communication of any sort of new relationship or unfaithfulness. It might be, sometimes we would say, it might be good to wait to marry until that person maybe has committed or has begun an immoral relationship. Because the warning, again, like you said, is that we don't want to create a situation where we are the ones that are entering into adultery. And in order for that to happen, Jesus says in the Matthew passage, except for sexual morality, any other divorce, that's causing everyone involved to commit adultery. Mm-hmm. That'd be kind of my...
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers this situation.
Maybe another part of that, maybe mm-hmm. if I'm understanding your question, my sense of your question is there are two people who claim to be believers, and one divorces the other, and the question is, were they believer or not?
Mm-hmm.
I think one piece of this is, when in that situation, when church discipline is pursued against the actively sinning member, I would say that the church has the ability to say, we no longer recognize your confession of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that the church body, through that discipline process, makes that declaration. I'm not saying they are a believer or not, because only God knows, but mm-hmm. that they no longer recognize their confession of faith, and that might clarify for
yeah.
7 months about as you're thinking about it. But the other piece that you're touching on is, can you get remarried or not in that situation? Mm-hmm. And like, there's difference among mm-hmm. believers about whether or not abandonment by a non-believer allows for remarriage or not. Mm-hmm. Kind of two different questions.
Because
yeah.
it does say, if they leave, the brother or sister is not under bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when we study seven, like, bound,
mm-hmm.
marriage, bondage, is how, like, we kind of...
You're bound to one another.
Yeah, so if you're no longer under bondage in such case, if that's the right way to interpret that, then you're
mm-hmm.
no longer in that marriage covenant if an unbeliever leaves.
Yeah, that word, there's a note in here, so let's look at that. So the word for bondage, or for bond there. So let's compare them. So in 7, we're comparing it to also the Romans 7, I believe.
Well, I think verse 15 is talking about divorce, not necessarily marriage.
I'm looking up my words here. I got my Greek. Yeah, I think, I mean, it is talking about whether or not you should continue to or maintain that marriage. So let me see here. 1 Corinthians 7. So the word there, to enslave, they're not enslaved, and they're not brought under subjugation, is the word there that's used in 1 Corinthians. And then flip over to Romans 7 as well. We kind of looked at this just a bit ago, a few minutes ago. So in chapter 2 there, or 7, verse 2, sorry, Romans, finding it here, Romans 7, 2. So the word there for the married woman is bound by law. So that means to bind, to tie together, to fasten, to compel, to declare or to be prohibited unlawful. And so I don't know that those are saying the exact same,
yeah,
same thing.
Different words.
There are different words. And you have same author for both books. And I'm choosing to use a different word there. So when you think about what else could he mean, right? If the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave, the brother or sister is not under bondage or is not called under subjugation. And so if that unbelieving spouse leaves, they're not bound by the to subject themselves to the requirements necessarily of marriage. Earlier in that passage, in 1 Corinthians, he was talking about how the husband and wife are compelled to fulfill the desires of the other. The husband's body is not his own, but it belongs to his wife. The wife's body is not her own. And so there's a sense in which you are both subject to one another. And so in this separation, the believing spouse is no longer obligated, in these cases, to seek to continue to maintain the marriage in the same way, fulfilling all those same requirements. And so it's allowing, I think, for the unbeliever to leave, but I think it falls just a little bit short of saying, go ahead and divorce them. I think if they fill out the divorce, if they complete the divorce, and if there's been sexual morality, that is what ends the marriage.
Yeah, I think when Jesus teaches against divorce, it's always in the context of committing adultery.
Mm-hmm.
So to commit adultery, there has to be a divorce and then a sexual encounter. And so it's possible to have a divorce without the sexual encounter. And in that case, the person is not committing adultery at that point. So I think that's the thing. It's the consummation of somebody of a marriage with somebody else. Consummation with somebody else is really the central command that Jesus is trying to uphold and prevent from violation.
But a little bit different, just going on verse 16, part of what we discussed when we were studying this, the unbelieving one leaves, our assumption is that the unbelieving one is divorcing the believing one.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, then, in 16, the reasoning behind that is not to, like, hang on to them so tightly, because that's just not helping if they want to leave. If they have the freedom to leave because they want to leave, then there is still that hope of them coming to Christ. This verse 16, where whether you will save your husband or whether you will save your wife, hoping that letting them go, you know, and not just clinging on to them so tightly, but letting them go, then the Lord will work through that. Possibly.
Yeah, I do think there is a little bit of a differentiation between divorce and then the remarriage, where I think where there is this sense in which it's possible that the divorce, when Jesus, looking back at his passage, say you get a divorce and it's not for sexual morality. Why is it that when that person remarries, they're committed to adultery?
Because it wasn't a lawful divorce.
And the people are still, you're still married. Mm-hmm. And so I think that sometimes confuses us, because in our mindset, if the Bible allows for divorce, which is kind of a legal public declaration, they write the certificate, that is the end of the marriage. And I think what Jesus is addressing is there was a lot in his day and a lot today where people are married and they file a certificate of divorce and they're still married. Okay? And that's why when they remarry, they're committing adultery. Okay? And so for us, we have to see that biblically, just writing a certificate of divorce doesn't necessarily end the marriage. Because if you do that for any other reason besides porneia, besides sexual morality, you are still married. And it's only when that sexual immorality occurs and the divorce, right, you get both of these are canceled out. There's sex porneia and there's an official official divorce because of that sexual morality. Usually that would have resulted in death. But there's been grace shown to the sexually immoral person, and so there's and also grace shown to the one who's been sinned against. That marriage can end, and they can both, or the one who was sinned against, they can remarry, and it's not counted as adultery. Yes?
What about, like, the case of physical abuse?
We're getting there, yeah. Yeah, it's coming up. Another easy one, right?
I was going to say, there's actually been a movement within the last few years to add abuse to one of the biblical
reasons.
Yeah, reasons for divorce. Wayne Grudem believes that,
mm-hmm.
for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they base it on 1 Corinthians 7:15, where it says, but if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not a slave, and they would put abuse in that, in such
that's
cases.
A such of a case.
Mm-hmm.
But that's broader than,
mm-hmm.
that's a broader category.
Yeah, and as I was thinking through it, there's a huge tension between our desire to protect and honor the spouse that is being sinned against and harmed versus God's desire and the value that he puts on the lifelong bond of marriage. And I think we probably in our culture are a little more heavily focused on the right and the protection of the individual and a little bit less on the value and the lifelong bond of marriage that God gives in his standard from Old Testament to New. And I think Jesus is reiterating this and would have probably been quite shocking to those in his audience to hear, no, it is not acceptable. You know, the Pharisees were saying that it was a command. In one of the sermons that I listened to on this topic, they said that some of the teaching of the rabbinical would say that it was almost even virtuous. If a man has a, you know, contemptuous wife, let him divorce her, right? He's purifying his life. And so they've received this teaching that you don't want to have this ungodly marriage. If it's something's wrong, then divorce. And Jesus is upholding marriage throughout, only through this sexual morality that would have ended in death.
Scott, one question going back, I'm sorry. With the example of the whatever, the spouse leaving, that's the unbeliever.
Okay.
They file for divorce. You said that you would oftentimes advise a break or like a time where the believer does not remarry. Because the spouse that left has not committed adultery. So they, you know, leave and go into a life of singleness and move states and they're gone. So how long would you wait for that person to get remarried?
Well, I would...
aside from the fact of, like, texting them, like, hey, are you sleeping with somebody yet? Like... that's what you're saying. Like, that's what it takes to have the divorce. Like, obviously, they're not going to do that. And, like, yeah, I've seen the example. And, like,
mm-hmm.
that person left states.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're no longer in contact at all with them. But they never got remarried. So, like, obviously, if they get remarried, like, oh, there's adultery because, like, they're going to sleep together.
Yeah.
If they're just single the rest of their life because they had a horrible marriage.
Dave's had more counseling and experience in real life application of this because, to be honest, divorce is extremely common. And so is, right, the reasons are very varied. And so it's something that probably all of us, again, know. So,
anything
to
add?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, social media is helpful in that. I'm serious, though. Like, as far as, like, you could tell, like, if your ex is going on vacation with their girlfriend to Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
you could probably put two and two together. And it's not as hard to figure out as you think.
But his point is,
yeah.
Let's say they never do.
They never do, then I would say, yeah.
You don't remarry.
You don't remarry. Because you don't want to take the chance of committing adultery.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But in most cases,
mm-hmm.
in most cases, if somebody is disobedient to the Lord and they're willing to do
mm-hmm.
that, they're willing to do a lot of sin as well to come along with it. But
so it is, when thinking through it, there is a lot of things that are very uncommon that make it, those are the real difficult ethical choices. But I think that is the point, is that the goal is to prevent you from committing adultery, being the one that that does that. And it's very straightforward and very narrow in the sense of what Jesus says, you know, could qualify for a divorce when the marriage ends. And so it's extremely, I think, you know, the earlier question about what if you have this toxic marriage. Staying married for life, regardless of what happens, is an extremely can be an extremely difficult thing, depending upon the spiritual condition and the character of one or both spouses. And so that's what I'm saying, that there's a great deal of you're embracing that marriage is not just, the goal is not just to have two happy people. You hope that there's a lot of joy and things that come through the marriage, but there's a lot of other things that are demonstrated through marriage too.
Just comes to mind, I talked about this before. Is there possibly an assumption that divorce will automatically mean the person will remarry? Like, that's just sort of a given. I said it because in Matthew 5 earlier, there's another adultery passage and divorce passage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He says, 5:31-32, it was also said, whoever divorces wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery. Let's just stop there. So it doesn't say she is sort of willfully committing adultery. It says he makes her commit adultery, which seems to assume that he's her granted, she's going to remarry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like the divorce is going to lead to remarriage.
Yeah.
As if there's not another option.
Yeah.
So I'm just muddy the waters. If a divorce is permitted, is the assumption automatically the person will get remarried? So in that case, you don't necessarily have to follow social media. You can assume, the assumption is the next step is going to take place.
Mm-hmm. And then you're saying not necessarily that you need to wait for that moment, but...
You can assume that moment's going to take place, yeah.
It is definitely
just having to hire an investigator.
Right. Yeah.
Or Dave have him stop.
Stock.
Dave stock. I have my secretary.
Yeah. Create your own website. It's a new business. Yeah. There is definitely that assumption, especially in the scriptures, I think, is that when a person divorces, they're going to. And I think it kind of displays that too, in just the sense that people were divorcing and marrying quite frequently, and it was very, very common. And so the assumption is, oh, they're getting divorced so they can remarry somewhere else.
Yeah, and being unmarried was an anomaly back then, especially if you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't have the employment opportunities and stuff like that. You see, I think in some of the Greek culture, it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of see that in Acts,
mm-hmm.
where you have a lot of widows, you know, who are able to kind of provide for themselves, and that might explain why 1 Corinthians does allow for separation and treats it as something that is viable in that culture.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't necessarily be possible here.
Yeah, and sometimes we get stuck on the cases that are very, very rare, and I think we want to make sure we don't miss the general teaching of what generally happens.
And in general, I've seen every... unbiblical divorce or whatever, they eventually, the guilty party eventually moves on.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there's like no hope for restoration.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Good place to stop. Yeah, go ahead.
Just because I'm confused. But oh. A real life situation. So, two people are married, they buy a house, they decide they're going to move in. Takes them a while, they finally start to move in. And she says, oh no. You're not moving in with us. The kids and I are going to move in here. You're not moving in. Okay. So I'm not going to move in. So, you know, try to go through counseling, whatever. Nope. Nothing happened. So she files for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So where is he? What does he do? And what can he do? And he is a believer. She is not.
Yeah.
What
so there... Yeah, so he lets her leave, she files for divorce, they're divorced. I would say for a time, until she's kind of moved on into a newer relationship or has committed adultery, they're kind of still maybe legally not married, but I would counsel them to wait to remarry.
Forever? Because what if she decides she and nobody wants her?
Yeah. It's tough. I don't think you're going to like my answer. I would say that if he were to remarry and his divorced wife, who has not committed any sexual morality, they would be committing adultery. And I would also say that most likely we have lots of believers who have been a part of unbiblical divorces. And I think sometimes the point of the text is that we don't want to get hung up on just the fact of what we ought to do, but we also don't want to miss what should we do moving forward. So let's say in that situation, the person has remarried, whether it was adulterous or not, he has no choice to go back and change anything that's happened in the past. And his goal, like in many of the marriages where you maybe had parents or you yourself or family members who are involved in an unbiblical divorce, we want to look forward to how do we move forward now with that knowledge that we have, and how should we live out in our marriage now. All right, let me pray for us. I feel like we need it. Father, I do just come before you, just in studying, much like the disciples after Jesus gave this teaching, they said, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry. And that they realized that the bond of marriage was much greater and stronger and higher than they had any concept of. And so I pray for us, this may be a shocking teaching to us. It may be difficult to receive, and it may leave us wondering what and we ought to do and how we ought to counsel those in our families and in our friendships and our churches. And so I just pray that we would just come to your word and come to you, knowing and trusting that you are a good God, a wonderful God, and a God that has a good plan, and in your word that you speak to us clearly. We do pray that you help us as we study the teachings of Jesus, as we study Paul's teaching in Corinthians, that you'd give us great wisdom and grace as we discuss this. Help us to know that there are some differing viewpoints, and help us to really think through and consider them, studying the language, studying the context, studying the history, and just being open to that discussion. And help us to both present our view and listen to other views, just in grace, seeking to honor you and seeking to, you know, as Jesus spoke, to prevent anyone from entering into an adulterous relationship, but honoring and glorifying you through the way that they act and the way that they live. And especially I just pray for each of us, for those that are unmarried, that they would take this teaching to heart as they consider marriage. For those of us who are married, help us to really look into the value and the esteem that you place on the covenant of marriage. And give us great grace as we counsel those who are in a situation where they have been left or abandoned, where once the spouse has been unfaithful and committed to adultery. Give us wisdom. Help us to point them to your word and to point them to your great grace that's shown towards all of us. Thank you for your word and for your guidance, and ask your Holy Spirit to continue to bless us. In your name, amen.